welcome to the Early Years Web Summit with me, Kathy Brodie of kathybrodie.com. In this summit, we're exploring children's personal, social and emotional development, and especially strategies as how we can help children in this key area of development. Today, I'm absolutely thrilled to be joined by Dr. Suzanne Zeedijk, who is a research scientist fascinated by babies' inborn capacity to communicate. She's been based at the University of Dundee since 1993 within the School of Psychology. In 2011, she set up her own independent training enterprise to disseminate more widely the science of early years, and now spends much of her time speaking to the public about our human need for emotional and psychological connection. She's able to bring this to her research expertise on topics including parent-infant relationships, family support, communicative disorders, and the socio-political context that frame our responses to scientific information. She works closely with organisations throughout the world to increase awareness of the decisions we take about caring for our children, illuminating the way in which those decisions are integral, connected to our vision for the kind of society that we want to build today. Welcome to the summit, Dr. Suzanne Zeedijk.
I am so delighted to be here. It's very visionary of you, Kathy, to offer this information to people so far across the world. I'm just delighted to be taking part.
I'm thrilled that we're able to put it around the world. It's amazing, isn't it? Today, we're going to be investigating drop-off and pick-up points in particular as a particular area of personal, social, emotional development. But before that, could you tell us a little bit about why you are so keen on spreading this message of connection, please?
Absolutely. As a scientist, I know that we have discovered all sorts of things about the importance of human relationships for our well-being and our just basic functioning in the world. Yeah. But I also came to realize after 20 years producing scientific insights that an awful lot of people who worked with children and indeed with adults weren't aware of that information. So I got really interested in working to see how we could translate that science to the wider public. And so that's what I did 5 years ago, was to step away from full-time academic work in order to try to reach the public. And that's a whole range of people. That's childcare and social workers and teachers and parents and politicians and manufacturers of baby buggies and retailers and musicians and police. Anybody who is interested in understanding more about human relationships work and how they affect us biologically. If we understood that, we would have a much better sense of how to solve many of the social problems that we face. And so I spend all my time now just trying to help make those scientific insights accessible for people and take away some of the big words that often scare people and help them to really apply theory and knowledge in real life settings. And I love it.
Yes, yes. That is quite a range of people that you're talking to there. And as you say, that communication, it's human, isn't it? So it needs to be across all those areas, doesn't it?
Well, it's when you get the basics of how important connection and relationships are, you begin to realize how widely spread it is. Yeah. And the thing that's really important about the early years is that the brain is being shaped in some quite fundamental ways during those early years, in ways that we didn't know even 20 years ago.
But
what we now know about how brains develop and why experiences are so important has often not yet reached parents and professionals. Yeah. And it doesn't mean that the brain doesn't go on to develop in other ways later on. And it also doesn't mean that you can't heal from early difficulties. Yeah. But it does mean that if we understood how very important the early years were, we could think better about the kinds of services we set up. We could think more deeply about the kind of care that we provide, and we could spend our money more wisely.
Yes,
that's why one of the reasons that early years information is absolutely so important.
Yes. Well, from an early years background, I couldn't agree more. But today particularly, I'd like to look at the area of dropping off and picking up. So that's when we're dropping our children off at settings, and it doesn't matter whether that's a childminder or a daycare setting. Could we expand a little bit on why you think that's such an important part of a child's day?
Absolutely. As I was thinking about this, I thought, actually, there are three key reasons that drop-off and pick-up, but especially drop-off, if we just think there for a minute, are so crucial. Mm-hmm. Okay, and one is that they set a child up for the day.
Yeah.
Because most often drop-off is happening in the morning. For some children, it's happening in the afternoon, so that's setting you up for the rest of the day.
Yeah.
But the way in which drop-off happens sets you up for that day.
Yeah, yeah.
And it has a biological impact. Often we think of it as just behavior.
Yes, absolutely.
Because that's what we see. But that's the point of all this connection stuff, is that our experiences in the world, and especially of other people, especially as children, have a biological impact on us.
Right, yeah, yeah.
So it's going to produce changes in children's hormones in their body. It's going to create connections in their brain about what partings are like.
Yeah.
So it's going to have a biological impact. And that's going to set you up for what comes later because of your biological state.
Yeah, yeah.
Secondly, it really is going to shape your brain, especially if you're young, okay?
Yeah.
Because your brain is developing more rapidly between birth and three,
yes,
and even a bit before birth, than it ever will again. So children's brains are learning what the world is like, and they're building connections in you know, literal neural connections,
yeah,
as a result of those experiences, including drop-offs. And we all know that drop-offs are very difficult for many children.
Absolutely.
And we can come back to why that is. But then thirdly, the reason that drop-offs are important is that because of those lessons that the brain learns, it sets up what partings are like for the rest of your life.
Wow, that's pretty powerful.
It's very powerful.
Mm.
And it becomes really important to today's world because so many of our children are now in professional care.
Yes, yes.
And many, you know, in the past, many children will have been in the care also of grandparents or other family members, and lots of children still are. But somehow we don't think of those as partings in the same way. And actually, we probably don't handle them in the same way.
No, that's true. We probably don't. Yeah, yeah.
So thinking about the way in which professional settings and professional care and our adult thoughts about what professional care should look like shapes children's unconscious experiences about what partings are like.
Yeah, yeah.
That then is going to go on to shape your biological expectations that are unconscious,
yeah, yeah,
in your marriage, in your friendships,
yeah,
in your, you know, in your partings from your parents when you fly in on, you know, in planes in future, all of those partings and reunions are being shaped in these very early years. Mm-hmm. And our children now have them every day, if many of them, when you're in professional care. So I think we need to think about that a whole lot more because it hasn't received nearly as much, certainly scientific attention as it should.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of practitioners are just winging it without you know, special guidance. So I think that we should think about that.
Yeah, and no, absolutely. And I know that you think about drop-offs and pick-ups as that classic attachment moments, don't you? So, and I know a little bit about attachment, but if you could just tell us a bit more about attachment and how that relates to drop-off and pick-up, please.
Sure. It's such a great question because it totally knits together the real life with the science.
Yes.
Okay, attachment is basically, there are lots of ways to describe it. It's basically our craving for relationships in our lives. So human beings have a biological need for connection to other people.
Yeah, yeah.
And we live in societies that are more and more disconnected.
Yes.
So that's one way in which we need to think about the importance of that biological need. When we, and all human beings, whatever their age, have an attachment system and a need for connection.
Yeah.
What happens in the early years, because our brains are developing so rapidly and we're learning what the world is like, is that we unconsciously learn what relationships feel like and whether they feel emotionally safe or they feel a bit anxious.
Ah, yes, yeah.
And all of that is unconscious, and we just come to think of it as normal as we get older, because we don't have a lot of conscious memories often of what is happening in those really early years.
Yes, of course. Yes, yes.
Okay. So one way in which we're learning how relationships function is when we part from other people and then when we have reunions with them. Mm. And in fact, when you think about that, it becomes fascinating to realize that all cultures have greeting and goodbye rituals.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. And of course you do that in different ways. So you have a handshake, or you give people a hug, or you give them a kiss, or you give them three kisses on either cheek, or you rub noses.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or you have a word that says hello, or good morning, or good afternoon, or good evening. Right. I love thinking about that little tiny thing, because we just do that without ever thinking about it. But they are reunion rituals.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Yeah.
And we say them even to people that were there when we went to, like, the night before. So all the people in your house, you still say good morning to.
Yes. Yes.
Or, you know, and I can make people laugh by saying, you know, you roll over if you're sleeping next to somebody in bed and say good morning, darling. Or you scowl. Or you might, I'm not supposed to say that because, you know, that seems a bit intimate. But actually, it's true. We all know that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And, okay, and then we go to wake our children up.
Yeah.
Okay, and we think about, this is where suddenly everybody who's listening to this will now be going, oh my gosh, yes, I shout up the stairs, or I play soft music, or I say, get up, you're late for school.
Again.
Rituals.
Yes, yeah.
About how you say good morning and hello.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we also have parting rituals, right? So we say goodbye, or we shake hands again. And if you say goodbye and then you realize you've forgotten your umbrella and you have to come back for it, somehow feels embarrassing because you've already said goodbye. Okay, get it.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are attachment moments.
And so even, I always think about attachment as being with babies and young children, but you're absolutely right. I've never really considered as adults, we're still replaying all those things that we learned, all the things. And I, you know, when I say goodbye to my mum on the phone, I did exactly the way that she's always done it to me when I was a child. So we're repeating those rituals as well, aren't we?
That's the way, you know, that's just the way we develop. That's the way relationships develop. They start early on, and with children, they start early in development, and then it just feels normal.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so here's, once we get that idea of normal and unthought about and unconscious, we can then start to think about what if normal actually is uncomfortable.
Ah, now, yes.
So normal can feel safe.
Mm-hmm.
Or it can feel anxious.
Mm.
It can feel easy or it can feel uncomfortable.
Yes, yeah.
And if you're a child with this rapidly developing brain, those feelings become part of the whole phenomenon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. If we link that then to the science, attachment research has been going on since the 1940s.
Yeah.
And it picked up a lot in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the key researchers in that was a woman named Mary Ainsworth.
Yeah.
And she developed a procedure called the strange situation paradigm.
Right.
And nobody who's listening to this has to remember any of those, but it's helpful to think, gosh, there's a procedure, a scientific, like, test that looked at partings and reunions. And in it, what the scientists did, and it's still used, is that you bring a mother or a father into a setting, an unusual setting, an unknown setting, and then after you've been there together for a little bit, the parent goes out of the room, leaving the child in the room with a stranger.
Wow.
And then the parent comes back in about 3 minutes later. And the key things that you're looking at in that is how the child copes with the parting and how the child responds to the reunion, and also how the adult participates in all of that.
Oh, that's interesting. Yes.
So that parting and that reunion is what our children do every day when they get dropped off
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
with
yeah.
someone else. And that someone else could be a group setting. It could be a childminder.
Yeah.
It could be a grandmother. It could be a grandfather. It could be, used to be your neighbor, your,
Yes,
trusted neighbor,
yeah.
but it's still a parting.
Yeah,
And
okay.
we think of it as a parting in the beginning of the day and a reunion at the end of the day, but actually it's both times, because you part from your carer and you have a reunion with your professional care. So you part from your mom and you have a reunion with your childminder, for instance. And at the end of the day, you part from your childminder and you have a reunion with your mom. Okay? And that becomes interesting because we think of it as kind of a parting at the beginning of the day and a pickup at the end of the day.
Exactly,
But
yes.
actually, it's both.
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. Now is when it gets really interesting to think about what does that whole transition feel like for a child?
Yeah.
So let's take a really stereotypical one. Mom brings the child into a group setting, so into nursery, and already the child is feeling anxious.
Yeah.
And actually, if we roll back in time, maybe the child has been getting anxious the whole time she's in the car. So the anxiety is already building because she knows she's about to get dropped off and she doesn't like it. Okay? And in fact, mom's getting anxious because she knows that this parting every day results in tears. So now already they're anxious. And I can make this really worse, okay? The child's in the back seat in a car seat. So the only way they have to connect is through the mother's voice. And if the mother's feeling anxious, that will show up in her voice, even if mom's trying really hard to hide it. And the child's very attuned brain can hear that. Okay, so now we get there. We're already anxious. We get to the setting, and I'm calling it a setting so we can think about those professional words. A child doesn't think of it as a setting. A child, it's kind of interesting to think, what word would a child use? Now, they might use the word nursery because that's the word that they've been given. But really, for them, it's home. It's another home. It's another home. It For them, it's part of their life. And they don't know that the people there get paid to take care of them.
No.
Their brain thinks that they're part of their family. That's what children's brains are meant to do. So they really think that, it's Auntie Kathy, or Auntie Suzanne, or even if they call them Mrs. Smith, their brain thinks that that's part of their family, their clan, their tribe. Okay. Well, what happens if that person who they really come to like, because it's their auntie, isn't there? Because the nursery thinks it's a service. And so they just have a random person who receives that child. Or maybe they're not a random person. They're one of 10 people. But that means that that child never knows who's going to be there to welcome them, to help them part from their mother or their father or their granny or whoever's dropping them off. And so maybe that's part of the anxiety for the child, is that they never know what is going to who is going to greet them.
Yeah.
And if they're struggling and that person isn't able to help them with that struggle, so you drop them off, and let's say some settings think that you're not really allowed to cuddle children.
Yes, I've heard that.
Yeah, there's been interesting discussions. In 2013 and 2014, there was quite a lot of discussion in the media about whether settings should be able to cuddle children or not.
Yeah.
And that's why it becomes important to think about the way adults think about it. If we think that this is professional, and that professional means that we're not meant to cuddle children, and in fact we're not meant to cuddle them because we're slightly anxious about touching children,
yeah,
which many professional settings are,
yeah,
when you cuddle children, it helps them to feel safe.
Yes.
It helps them to calm down. It helps a hormone called oxytocin to rise, and that in their bodies.
Yeah.
And that helps them cope with disappointment and emotional pain. So if we're not cuddling children in the middle of this transition,
yeah,
we're not giving them the biological help that they need to cope with something that's difficult for them.
So
several things in that long account I've just given you there are that the way we think about this as adults, do we think that this is professional and that means we need to be distant?
Yeah.
We'll shape it. The staff rota will shape it, because it's your staff rota that that makes it possible for the key person to be present for that child.
Yeah.
But also, if you have a start time where a number of children arrive all at once, and
yes,
group settings do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Then you don't have time to pay attention to individual children, because you've got lots of children at your, you know, all around, which is different for, say, a childminder.
Yes, yes.
And so once we start to think about these tiny details and realize that they're crucially important for a baby's and a young child's brain, we start to realize that drop off at childminders is likely to be very different from drop-off in a group setting.
Yeah, 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 absolutely.
And then those lessons get built into a child's brain, and they unconsciously carry them into the future. And now they're going to be dropped off at school in a few years' time.
Yeah, yeah.
They've had very different drop-off experiences, probably, if you've been dropped off at granny's as opposed to dropped off at a childminder's, as opposed to dropped off at a group setting.
Yeah, yeah.
And we just don't realize, and we just call it drop-off.
Exactly. And that's very often what school will say. Have they been to a setting before? Very rarely do they say, was it a childminder? Was it a grandparent? Was it a large group setting, a small group setting? They just ask, have they been somewhere else? And as you say, that experience is going to be vastly different, isn't it?
Vastly different. And we have no research that tracks that over time. So children who are struggling at school. Okay, so imagine that you have a child who's had a long history of drop-offs that were uncomfortable, and now it goes on to be dropped off at school. As soon as they're starting, you know, primary one, they're starting in a different emotional place about separation from parents than children who had more supportive experiences of drop-off.
Yeah, yeah.
And so if you start your day with cortisol in your system, that's a stress hormone that if you had difficult drop-offs, you would have more of. You're starting your educational day with a higher amount of stress hormone.
Yeah.
That impacts on your ability to learn.
Well, of course, yeah. Yeah. And as you say, that's at a biological hormonal level. And what we're doing is actually flooding children's bodies with that hormone by the way that we handle those things, aren't we?
We are. Now, having said that, there are lots of things we can do to help. Because here's what my brain is doing right this moment. I'm now thinking about all the people watching this.
Mm.
Okay. And many of them may be professionals, so they're thinking about their professional practice. But many of them will also be parents.
Yes.
So when I talk about attachment and connection, I'm trying to help it to be really real and not theoretical. But I walk a very difficult line because as soon as it becomes too real, lots of us go into place of guilt.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. I didn't know that when I was dropping my child off. I just did what the provider suggested. I knew she was crying, but I didn't know how to help. So right now, there'll be a whole lot of people listening to this that are feeling guilty. And I don't want anybody to feel guilty. So, and yet, I want us to take this information seriously. So the challenge is, how do we hear this information that feels anxious for many of us? Because we want to do the best for our children that we can.
Of course, yeah.
How do I get us to take it seriously and yet not tip over into feeling bad about ourselves? And the answer is that we do the best we can. We work with the knowledge that we had at the time. Yeah. No child needs perfect parents, and no child needs a perfect childcare provider either. Relationships are not perfect. They're messy. That's attachment.
Yes.
The crucial thing to realize is that there may have been consequences left over from earlier in life that could help to explain what we're struggling with now. And understanding that gives us a way to tackle challenges that we might have now. So if you suddenly looking back over your life, realize I could have had really high cortisol levels then. It's likely that you still have high cortisol levels at parting.
Yes, yeah.
And so you can start to pay attention to what you struggle with. So, for instance, if you do attachment theory, and some people watching this may have heard of avoidant attachment patterns or ambivalent attachment patterns. If you don't know about those, it doesn't matter. But just to say there's a fancy name for it. People with ambivalent attachment patterns struggle in distance. Okay, they struggle with partings. So their body starts to go, oh, the person I love hasn't told me recently that they love me and they still matter to me. So I start to get kind of unconsciously anxious.
Yeah.
And there are lots of people out there who identify with, you know, you send a text and you don't get a text back. So you send another text, and you start to get anxious that you've not got a text back. And I try to make it funny, but the thing is, there are people who identify with this.
Absolutely, yes, I'm right with you.
The lack of getting a text back starts to raise cortisol levels.
Yeah.
Now some people will go, that is really silly. Calm down.
Yeah.
But if you have been wired to be anxious about partings,
yeah,
it makes totally sense that the cortisol levels are rising.
So that's almost your go-to place then, isn't it? That's your default setting, as it were.
Yes.
Yeah.
So if you can then start to be aware in adulthood or teenagehood, that is where I get anxious. I get anxious in the parting.
Yeah.
You can start to think about what is going on biologically. And then you can start to go, okay, how could I help myself with that? So yoga and meditation and all these bodily practices help breathing when you send your text and you've not got a reply. But other people are more anxious in the reunion. And that's one way to describe avoidant attachment.
Okay.
And if you're into all of that disorganized attachment, which often comes from real extreme trauma, is anxious at both distance and closeness. So imagine how difficult that pattern is.
That's
a securely attached people are pretty okay with both.
Right.
Okay, now, I've gone way into, you know, grown-uphood there. Because it helps us to get it. But if I come back to what we're supposed to be talking about here, which is drop-off and pick-up, we can now see how a child's experiences of drop-off and pick-up are about reunions and partings.
Yes.
And why they are so important. Because in our modern Western worlds, we have children in professional care in a way that we wouldn't have had in evolutionary history of human beings.
Yeah, Yeah, and we've got that double whammy going on at the moment, haven't we, with more and more children going into settings, as you say. Also, attachment theory is a relatively new kind of theory. It's certainly, well, as you say, the 70s is sort of like when it gained most popularity, wasn't it? So that's a reasonably kind of new area as well. So we've got both of those things coming together now. But I'd never thought about how that then impacts on further life.
Well, Kathy, if I can interrupt you for a second there. I think it's fascinating to think about the fact that we have had attachment theory since the 1970s.
Yeah.
And a whole lot of people don't know about it and therefore can't make use of it.
Yes.
So I actually, in some ways, at one level, I think it's kind of shocking that we could have had Mary Ainsworth doing her research, which is about partings and reunions, and we have not applied that to drop-offs and pickups for childcare.
Yeah, yeah.
So part of me says that is not new. That has been around a long time.
Yeah.
And in fact, that goes all the way back to the 1940s and 50s with hospital practice.
Ah, yes. Okay?
So very briefly, in the 1950s, children who went into hospital were parted from their parents and didn't see them for days.
Oh, my goodness.
And so now we think that that probably created some emotional difficulties for many adults in the world, but they didn't know.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
So that's a whole nother conversation is hospitals.
Yeah.
Right. But here's another thing to think about attachment theory. Many people know about attachment parenting.
Yes. Yes.
And that is now a huge debate. So you read all over the papers at the moment. Should we be using attachment parenting? Does attachment parenting make parents feel more guilty? When you have to be parted, does attachment theory make women especially feel guilty?
Yes, yes.
Attachment theory, as we kind of know it in the wider public, has not helped us often to feel calmer. It has often made us feel more anxious.
Yes.
And I don't want it to do that because I think it has hugely helpful things to tell us about the biological functioning that we all do as human beings.
Yes, yes.
And so if we can understand that it's about the way in which it influences our biology and how that taps in actually now to a lot of the study of trauma.
Yes, yes.
We can see its value in new ways.
Yeah.
And so that's what I'm trying to help, is to help us to step out of a lot of the anxiety and help us to step into curiosity.
Yes. And you said right at the very beginning that often we're dealing with the behaviours rather than the actual core root of what's going on, the sort of the hormonal changes and so on. So very often what we're doing is just putting a sticking plaster on those behaviours at the end rather than going right back and saying, this is where it's come from. This is the core root of it.
Totally, because we see it as behavior.
Yes, yes.
And somehow we have this cultural message that says, I as a parent or childcare staff, my job is to deal with behavior.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But if we begin to get the message that all behavior is driven by an emotional state, an emotional need, and that emotions are biological.
Yes.
We can then get curious about behavior. So I was reading a piece about temper tantrums.
Oh, yes.
And how temper tantrums are about a child's often a need to discharge a whole lot of emotional energy.
Yeah.
And now we're embarrassed by it because children kick and scream and shout. And if we're in public, you get embarrassed by the behavior. Somehow we think that it's about us as parents managing our children's behavior.
Yeah.
That you can go on courses for managing behavior.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I would use the language of responding to emotional needs.
Yes, yes.
And if we see all behavior as a request for emotional help.
Yeah, yeah.
Then we begin to read all of that behavior differently.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And it's a much more positive way of looking at it as well, rather than trying to, you talk about tackling behaviour and challenging behaviour, and it's all quite negative, isn't it?
Yep.
But meeting an emotional need, who wouldn't want that? You know, I just think that's so powerful. Absolutely. Yeah.
So if we begin just by changing our language, it gives us new insights. So I can think of a school that I have worked with in Fife, who just changed their language from challenging behavior to distressed behavior.
Wow. Yeah.
And they say that it transformed their school.
Wow. Yeah,
now, I know we're talking about drop off and pick up, but because that taps into attachment, all of this helps us to think about attachment needs in a much bigger way. And that school was able to really meet the needs of their children, you know, they were able to do that in a much better way. Not because they got in a big, you know, emotional management program, but simply because the language that they were using changed the way they were reading children's behavior. So that's a really inspirational message for lots of schools.
Yes.
And is just as applicable to childcare settings.
Absolutely.
As it is to educational settings.
Yeah, yeah. I just think that's fascinating that, as I say, I know a little bit about attachment, but to make all those connections, I don't think I've ever kind of made them all the way through, as you say, to adulthood. So what sort of research is there that's going on at the moment about this sort of area?
There is very little research going on about drop-off and pick-up.
Really?
There is. And I think that that's because it's just sort of so normal. It's just a normal part of every day. We often miss the scientific insights and value of everyday experiences.
Yes.
Although I don't know why, because if what we are learning about children's behavior and the way brains develop and the importance of relationships isn't relevant to every day, then why are we getting that information?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So there are a few papers that have looked systematically at drop-off and pick-up, but there are very few. So if there are scientists or there are students watching this, perhaps that, you know, that's a little flag for saying that would make great projects.
Oh, it would be a fantastic master's dissertation, wouldn't it? It'd be amazing.
Amazing.
Yeah.
So what that leaves people doing, since we don't have a whole lot of evidence to draw on, is one of two things. They either might make the link from theory, and that's what I'm doing here, right? So when I'm talking about the importance of drop-off and pick-up, it's not because I can't cite a whole lot of studies that have systematically studied drop-off and pick-up, which is often what we think of as evidence.
Yes, yes.
Instead, what I'm working from is our theoretical knowledge about the importance of brain development and the processes involved in that, about what we know about attachment.
Yeah.
And I'm applying all of that really valuable, important theory to a specific situation of drop-off and pick-up.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's quite, I mean, that's, some people have wondered, is that ahead of the data?
Yeah.
Well, if attachment tells us about the importance of relationships and drop off and pick up, I think it's a perfectly legitimate and helpful application.
Yeah.
Once you understand how process works, you don't have to have applied it to every single tiny situation in order to gain insights. And in fact, that general theory helps us to think about the reunion and parting when you're putting a child in a car seat, or when you're lifting them out of a car seat, or when you're putting them into high chair, and when you're taking them out of high chair, or when you need to go to the loo and you're going to leave them in the front room for just a minute. Those are partings and reunions as well. They're just teenier ones.
Now,
we have no research that is called what to do when you are going to the loo.
No, we don't. And we should, definitely.
But we have attachment research and brain development research, which would still be very helpful in thinking about those moments.
And sometimes it is bringing together all those different disciplines and all those different areas where the insights come. It's not until you put all those layers together that you can see the whole picture forming, is it?
Absolutely.
I know that in England we certainly have the requirement that we have a key person system, and that's based very much on the attachment theory and the idea that you have that connection. And I know that a lot of countries, they call them different things, but they do have special people that you drop off and pick up from. But are there any guidelines or anything that governments that you know of about drop-offs and pick-ups?
That's a brilliant transition into thinking, okay, where are people getting their ideas about how to do drop-off and pick-up? Because we do them every day, right? When you start to think about that, okay, so where do we get our ideas about how that should happen? And it's happening in one of two ways. Either you are applying this theory, best you know how, or you do it intuitively.
Yes.
And most people are doing it intuitively.
I would agree, yes.
Which makes total sense, because we do goodbyes and hellos intuitively all the time.
Yeah.
So why wouldn't you do drop off and pick up at professional settings intuitively as well?
But
everybody who is engaged in that knows how awful it can get.
Yeah, it can be very stressful.
It can be very stressful. And in fact, I had a mother who emailed me just this morning before we sat down to do this, who said she'd been to hear a talk I'd given and I'd mentioned drop-off and pickups. And she was writing to ask, could I help? Because they talk a lot about it and she feels really confident in her relationship with her daughter. But she still says, we say goodbye and she is inconsolable.
Oh.
And so she's thinking a lot about it. And this is a childminder, so it's one-on-one.
She's
still saying that her daughter is inconsolable. So this is what she's asked. How can I give more teddy bear moments to overcome the saber-toothed tiger moments of saying goodbye?
Yeah.
And I'm reading that so that we can think, there is a real mother out there today who needs to hear this and would find this helpful.
Yeah.
But she's also using this language that I use of saber-toothed tigers and teddy bears to give us a different way to think about this. So internal teddy bears for me are our capacity to come for ourselves.
Yeah.
When I don't get that text back
yes.
and I'm starting to get anxious, can I comfort myself?
Yeah.
Because the saber-toothed tiger moment is the parting.
Yeah.
Or for some children, the saber-toothed tiger moment is the reunion.
Yeah.
And then for some couples, the saber-toothed tiger moment is reunion. In other words, saber-toothed tiger is a moment of fear.
Yeah.
Okay. So you ask, where do we get guidelines and really what should we be doing? That's why the language is so important. How do I help this child comfort themselves in the middle of what is a stressful moment? So the word comfort makes me think, as an adult, I have to help this child comfort themselves. And if I can do that, they'll be able to comfort themselves in the future. If I'm not helping them grow an internal teddy bear every single morning and every single afternoon when you get picked up, I am not building their resilience.
Yes.
So... and since I am as an adult, I am participating in this. If I don't think that partings are a very big deal because they don't bother me, I might not understand why this child is inconsolable. So I might not be very attentive and attuned because they don't bother me. So all of this requires us to get really curious about what that behavior means for someone else and to get really curious about where their saber-toothed tiger moments come and why that is such a struggle for a child and how I can help to support them and grow a stronger internal teddy bear, to use my language.
Yeah. I think that's a very powerful image, that as well, because the saber-toothed tiger and the sort of fear, and it does, it turns them into fight or flight, and all that, that sort of basic emotions start to come to the fore then. And that's exactly the behavior you see, isn't it?
So then that leads us immediately into, okay, what should I do?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And this is when we can start to think about what guidelines are out there, because some childcare settings do have guidelines.
Mm.
But many of them don't, because we have not thought about this.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
So if we just take a basic attachment thinking like we've been talking about, here are some things it tells us. Never disappear.
Mm.
A standard way of doing this in the past, but not so much anymore, was that childcare staff, understandably, because you had this sobbing child.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're not all sobbing. I've described a lot of sobbing children. I suddenly think, I want to stress, this is not anxious for all families.
Yeah. Yeah.
And all children. And so they're not all sobbing. And for some of them, once they were sobbing, but they're not anymore.
Yes, yes, yeah.
But I don't want to take that for granted, because then it lets us think, what happened for that child that it is not so distressing?
Yeah.
What happened in that transition?
Yeah.
Or are children, actually they're not crying, but they're stuffing anxiety. So you don't necessarily have to be crying for it to mean anxiety.
Yeah, true, true. Mm.
But the behavior that we tend to tune into most is inconsolable crying.
Yeah, of course, yes.
So the advice used to be, just go, just go.
That's right.
I've got them, just go, and he'll be fine later. But here's what a child learns if you disappear without having said goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
A child learns that a parent can disappear when they don't know when that's going to happen.
Yeah, yeah. That's it. Now, that's what you're teaching them, isn't it? Yeah.
That's exactly what you're teaching them without ever having meant to.
Yeah.
We teach our children lessons we didn't mean to. So the first place, you have to get curious and forgive yourself if you think, I taught them that lesson, because you're doing your best.
Yes, yes.
So if you learn that your parent can just disappear, that's not a comfortable message to learn.
No, no.
So being able to say goodbye and participate in that is really important. And most childcare settings now, when you talk to them, that's what they do. You know, they're not saying just go. But if there are childcare settings out there who are still doing that now, I'm hoping that this conversation will help them to think about that in new ways.
Yeah.
But it also means that if a child is sobbing a lot, that you need a key person who can help them while they have to do this difficult thing of say goodbye to mommy or daddy or granny.
Yeah.
And then what they're learning is that if I have to do this hard thing, there's someone to help me.
Yes. Yeah.
And in best practice, they would be there to help me until I feel really recovered.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I have sat in settings and really recovered takes till lunchtime.
Yes. And of course, it might be being picked up soon after lunch as well. So you're starting that cycle all over again, aren't you? Yeah.
And if you have a staff ratio that doesn't permit you to sit with a child on your knee until lunchtime, what do you do? And the question we need to ask ourselves is, what do we do?
Yeah.
Because if we just go, well, I can't provide that, then we need to understand we are shaping children's attachment patterns.
And
I know that it causes us some real difficulties, but we need to engage in that.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there are nurseries that, in trying to take this on board, have changed their staff rotas.
Ah.
They have their, some of them have their staff work longer days.
Yeah.
So a long 4 days a week, but for longer days.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of them have considered the financial implications of changing staff rotas.
Well, of course, yes, yes.
So we need to hear from more nurseries that are really trying to take on board the importance of drop-off and pick-up as attachment moments to hear how they're handling that.
Absolutely. Do you think there is much awareness out there of how important this is?
No. So when we start to understand the basics of attachment, and in this case, drop off and pick up, we can then start to think through the practical implications and the perhaps financial implications and the staff rota implications.
Absolutely, yeah.
And staff are supporting both the children and the parents.
Yes.
So some settings now call parents to, you know, to say, here's how they're doing. Because if you send a parent off to work and they're anxious about this difficult parting that we just had.
Yeah, yeah.
Then they're having trouble focusing on work because their cortisol levels are high.
Well, of course, yeah, yeah.
But we call it childcare. We don't call it parent care.
True.
Or family care.
Yeah, yeah.
And actually, childcare settings are family care services.
Yes. Yes, they are. Yeah, yeah.
Which is why I really like playing with language. So if you call yourself a family care service, what does that mean we are responsible for doing? But you are.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So drop-offs and pickups are these crucial transitions during the day.
Yeah.
And as a childcare provider, you are responsible for facilitating that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even if you didn't know it until you just heard that.
Yes, yeah.
Because parents do what a childcare setting has them do.
Yes, true.
Okay. So let's jump to pick up, because we haven't talked a lot about that. Here's what happens in a lot of childcare settings, because we're trying to do the best we can in a environment that now says we need to report on how the child's day was, and we need to show you the things we wrote down.
Yes, yes.
Okay. So in many settings, a parent can walk through a door. You have a child over here who's been waiting all day long to see mommy or daddy.
Yeah.
And we greet you at the door.
Yeah.
And we say, hello, Mrs. Johnson or Mr. Johnson. Let me tell you how she did today. We had a great day. Now, she fell over and we had to put a plaster on her knee. And she didn't really like the grapes at lunch. Now, the whole time, your child is still running around over here.
Yeah.
They are so anxious to get back in your arms.
Yeah, yeah.
But what is happening is that you are having a conversation of information.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So in an attachment-led reunion, you'd flip that.
Mm.
So the priority would be facilitating the reunion of the parent and child.
Yeah, yeah.
In a way that feels good for that parent. And then you would do the information exchange.
Right, yeah. That's a really simple strategy, but that makes so much sense. That really makes so much sense.
And once you get attachment theory, it's obvious, which is why, to go back to our earlier point, I think we've had this since the 1970s.
Yes.
True. How have we not used it to help us think about this?
Yeah, yeah.
In deeper ways.
Yeah.
Now, okay. So I hope that anybody who's listening to this will go, I can do that.
Yes. Yeah.
But here's the problem, or here's a problem. If a parent is listening to this and they want to try that in their childcare setting, but the childcare setting doesn't know about this.
Yeah.
The parent will now have to be very brave.
Mm-hmm.
And they will have to say, no, I want to change the system. And I want to reconnect with my child first.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's possible that the system won't like that. Yeah. Or that the childcare provider could feel offended.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Anxious.
Yeah.
So it takes a very brave parent who might know about this, but wants to do something different from the childcare setting.
Yeah.
If they're not sure if that's okay with the childcare setting.
Yeah.
So it's really powerful to have childcare providers know about this, think about this, and know that they are setting up the rhythm that will help their parents to step into and feel safe about.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, if they can also provide some attachment information that explains why they're doing that.
Yes.
then that typically makes everybody really excited.
Yeah. As you say, the theory is there, isn't it? It's there to be used. It's absolutely.
Here's another tip that applies it. Turn off mobile phones.
Oh, yes.
Because in today's world, it's now very common. We're all, more and more of us are addicted to our phones, and you hear about how phones are interfering with relationships. And
Yeah, absolutely.
what attachment theory tells us is that when I reconnect with a person who I've been missing, what I need for a split second or longer is their attention.
Yeah.
On average, hugs last 3 seconds.
Oh, I did not know that.
Three
Yeah.
seconds. Of course, that will vary by culture and things, but
Yes.
you think 3 seconds doesn't sound very long.
Yeah.
That 3 seconds is cut off if I'm looking at my mobile phone. So
Yeah.
I'm the child who comes running out of school,
Yeah.
and my parent is just finishing that task of sending off the mobile phone.
Yeah.
And then they tune in, but that moment is lost.
Yeah.
And so it's really important to be very present as an adult in that moment before you make a reconnection.
Yeah.
I was meeting a colleague in the train station a couple of weeks ago who I was very excited about seeing, but her train was late. And so I was doing things on the phone. And all of a sudden, I thought, Suzanne, I think that you should apply what you talk about. You don't know when that train is coming in, but it's due in a few minutes. Put down the phone so that when she walks through that barrier, I'm present.
Yes,
And my
yes.
face is saying, welcome.
Yeah.
So it's little tiny moments. It's really simple, but it's not easy if we
Yeah.
become addicted to phones.
Yeah. But again, a very simple strategy that's so easy to do, isn't it? And again, you could talk settings can talk to parents and say, "We appreciate you're very busy, but could you just put your phone in your pocket before you even come into the car park?" And then you know that they're going to be there and present, ready for the children, aren't they?
Because we now know that that's shaping their brains.
Yes.
That's going to make their marriage better. Right? It
Yes.
makes people laugh because you go, their marriage better. They're two.
Well, yeah. Where does it
Except that
start? Yeah.
attachment is te teaches us that's what you're learning is what relationships feel like. And then if I really push this, Kathy, at the cutting edge of science that many people don't yet know about, is that we can even map dementia symptoms
Wow.
onto attachment patterns.
Really?
Yeah.
Right, I'm not going to. That's really interesting, but I will put a link on the
Okay, so
website.
all I'm trying to
That's.
say is that this extends across the whole of the lifespan
Wow,
in ways
yeah.
that we haven't thought about.
Yeah.
And we're doing an early years summit, and most of the people I talk to are early years.
Yes.
I and others could help care home with elderly,
Yeah,
but they don't
yeah.
get this kind of information because that's not in our general awareness. So
Yes.
I'm just really trying to help us to see how important these little tiny moments are.
Yeah, absolutely.
If I say one more thing, Kathy, okay, so we've just talked about a few ideas about drop-off and pickup.
Yeah.
In today's world, more and more children are not dropped off in settings by their parents. What happens is children get dropped off at a childminder. The childminder takes them to nursery. The drop-off happens when they get picked up, they're picked up by the childminder, and then their parent picks them up from the childminder. So if you think about that, that child has had one, two drop-offs in the morning
Yeah.
and reunions, and one, two reunions and drop-offs in the evening. They've already had four major experiences of parting.
Wow. Yeah.
And so every single one of those are important,
Yeah.
whether they're our child or they're a child we're caring for.
Yeah.
And we just need to think much more about that as a society.
Yes, and I think you're absolutely right. It's cultural as well, isn't it? And how that society takes that as a norm, as a given. This is what happens, almost without thinking of those consequences. Yeah. So we've looked at a couple of top tips and a couple of really easy strategies to employ there. But excitingly, I think you've been creating some resources to help communicate that real importance to drop off and pick up. Are you able to tell us a bit more about those resources at this point?
By the time this goes out, I hope that the films, training films that we've been making, will finally be launched. We've been trying to get these out for months now. But of course, there's only so much time, and I have this little tiny team that we create these with. So if I just had three lifetimes, we'd have all sorts of resources. Yes. So in terms of drop-off and pick-up, we have been creating films where we literally filmed drop-off and pick-ups in nurseries and then narrate those to help people see in detail what is happening for children. And what we try to do, show is really positive drop-offs, because this helps us to think again, what kind of resources do we need? Yeah. Very often the drop-offs where children are and pick-ups where children are struggling the most are the ones that are most informative for us as viewers.
Yeah.
But they don't feel good for people who did the drop-off, even if they didn't know.
Yeah.
So it becomes interesting to think about, how could we see that? What could we create? Do we need animations? Would that be helpful?
Yeah.
It just helps us to start thinking more broadly. But what we've been doing is putting together films of positive drop-offs and then narrating it and slowing them down so you can see what's happening.
Brilliant.
But we also have, at the moment, we have e-courses that talk about wider attachment. And within those, I talk a bit about drop-off and pick-up and hormones in bodies and brains. So there are e-courses that we have at the moment. We have a suite of three e-courses, actually. We have books, which are meant to be short and accessible on attachment, and especially attachment, but also some of the other topics within this. In fact, one that we have out is on dementia. So that was already
That's
out there.
That's really interesting, yeah.
And we have some others that are due out shortly. We have a whole raft of videos and handouts, information sheets on my website.
Brilliant.
And we also now have little teddy bears, which are little teddy bears, which I mean, not just for children, but also for adults. I often think of them as sitting on the top of your computer.
Yeah, yeah.
Because computers are a place that can cause frustration. Mm-hmm. And they have little t-shirts on them with fighting saber-toothed tigers on them. Because internal teddy bears are what help us fight saber-toothed tigers. They're meant to help us laugh.
Oh, how lovely.
But to be a reminder that all the time I need to be drawing on my internal teddy bear, and I need to be boosting his or her capacities if I think, you know, that he's struggling in some way.
So
we have tried to come up with all sorts of resources that are just fun reminders or training reminders for people.
Yeah.
But in terms of drop-off and pick-up, we have these new films about to come out. And by the time this goes out, I hope they will be with the public.
Oh, I can't wait. And there will be a link on the website to that so people can click through. And just to remind people that your website is www.suzannezdyke.com. And if you search on that, it's the first one that comes up. And I know you're a big Twitterer because I follow you obsessively. And that's that's at Suzanne Zdyke again. And Facebook, tell me about the stuff that you do on Facebook, because that's really exciting.
Well, on Facebook, I put up a post every night about connection and disconnection.
Mm.
And so it's there for anybody who wants to follow it. You know, some weeks we reach about 50,000 people.
Wow, yeah.
Through people sharing. And I do that because, you know, they're often news articles, or they might be new research reports, or there are videos, you know, just on YouTube. So they're just ways of helping people to take this science and apply it in real life.
Yeah.
And I purposely post a whole wide range of topics so that we keep in mind how widely this really applies. So every single night there's a new post there, and it makes it easy for people to share.
Oh, absolutely. I just think that's amazing. I can imagine that there'll be, as you say, because it's so wide, that there'll be people that in the staff room saying, did you see that one? Can we discuss that in the staff meeting? Because there's going to be something there for somebody. It's just amazing. So that's really good.
I still can't believe how well social media works in spreading words, because sometimes I'll put out a post and I get up in the morning and it's been shared, you know, 30,000 times, you know, it's reached 30,000 people. Yeah, and you just think, how did that happen overnight?
Yes. Yeah.
But the other thing I should add, Kathy, is that you can also search under Connected Baby. So Connected Baby is what we produce all the resources under. So it gives us more of an organization, because I want these ideas to, you know, outlive me. And so Suzanne Zeedyke gives you often my particular take on things, and Connected Baby is where we're creating the resources that more people can draw on. Because I didn't want it to be, you know, the Suzanne Zeedyke theory, because it's not. It's about connection. And so when we started producing resources, I wanted a name that really captured that we were about connection and about the importance of those baby years, even if we are talking about adult life. So both of those you could search under.
Yeah, lovely. Thank you very much. And thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Suzanne Zeedyke. It's just been amazing. There's so much I'm going to have to go away and look up as well and just remind myself all those things. But that has been very, very interesting. Thank you very much indeed for sharing all your expertise on the Early Years website with us today.
Kathy, thank you so much for having me. I've been really honored.
Oh, no, it's been great. And thank you very much to our viewers and listeners for tuning in to the Early Years Web Summit.